In 1982, there was a famous Cruzan case where there was a woman who was in a car accident and she was kept alive by machines in a vegetative state. Her family wanted to take her off the IV and the feeding tube, which was keeping her alive. And the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that life is protected unless a person clearly communicates that this is their wish regarding the removal of life support. In other words, only the person himself can make this decision. And the person has the right, themselves have the right to refuse treatment, even if they're not suffering from a terminal illness. So what this did, this court case severely limited the family ability to make a decision. Now, we're going to see that the very big difference between not receiving treatment and the opposite, which is, of course, the story of Jack DeVorkis, the infamous doctor of death, who said he participated in over 100 assisted suicides. And the famous case in 1999, he was convicted to 15 years of second-degree murder, and he spent 8 years in prison. Okay. Someone close the door. We got the AC. We might as well take advantage of it. Thank you. Sorry? No, I don't believe so. Sounds Armenian or something. In 2005, the Terry Schiavo case further tested the limits of life and death, end of life cases. Her husband testified that she said she did not want to be kept alive by a feeding tube. Now, apparently, he filed a petition to remove it after the financial settlement was granted to her. I think it might have had to do with life insurance or whatever it was. So after he knew that certain funds were secured, then he came and said, no, she said she wanted to be taken off. And the family, based on the fact that she was a practicing Catholic, said she would have not wanted to be taken off the life support system. The court ruled with the husband's testimony, despite the attempt, remember, to have a congressional motion, I think, that she should not be taken off. The courts ruled that with the husband's testimony that that was her will and she was taken off life support. And people today, there was a recently enacted federal law that people today, when they enter hospitals and nursing homes, have to be informed about their rights to execute a living will. In other words, to give their own what they would want if they are kept alive on life support systems. And as we know, medicine has become more and more complex, and medicine is the ability to maintain a person in life for longer and longer periods. We've got a pediatric cardiac surgeon comes here. And Friday night he was telling us, he was saying that they now have a machine where if the child has heart trouble, they have an external heart pumping the blood. They hook the arteries up to the machine from the baby, and the external heart is pumping the blood until they can operate on the heart or until the baby gets older and they can operate. So the boundaries of medicine are going further and further. So, but whether it's, unfortunately, people close to us who might be older, parents, grandparents, where we have end-of-life issues come up, or even for oneself, even if there's not something that come up, really people should have a living will. Because otherwise these decisions will be either just not made or made by others or made by the courts. So what does Jewish tradition tell us about end-of-life issues? About being kept alive through life support systems, about can you remove a person if they are in a coma or a vegetative state. And we're going to deal with other questions. can you have a medical procedure if you know that it might be endangering? In other words, what if, God forbid, a person's ill, they can try a treatment, but it might put their life in danger. Are you allowed to put your life in danger for something that might wind up being a cure? And to what extent? Can a person decide and say, I'd rather not live if I'm going to live like this, so I'll take the chance? Okay? These are very complex and difficult ethical dilemmas. And what we're going to see, the amazing thing, is that Judaism, the Torah, has principles which help us to navigate through these questions of life and death. So, the first place to start is that the Torah views life as having an absolute value. Okay? Human life is supreme over even the dictates of the Torah. It says in the Torah you should live through the commandments, and from there, if a person's life is in danger, even the Shabbat, which is the highest sanctity, is suspended. Even Yom Kippur is suspended. A famous story of Rabbi Yitzchok Salanter, the great saintly figure who got up in front of his community in Leipzig when there was a cholera epidemic, and he made Kiddush on Yom Kippur and drank the wine or the grape juice from the front of the congregation, because it was dangerous to one's life to not eat. Immune system would get weakened, and you're more likely to contract the disease. So it's not only allowed to eat, but it's a commandment to eat. So life, human life, supersedes all the commandments of the Torah. And furthermore, the Torah tells us that, if you look at the first text, if you save a life, it's tantamount to saving an entire world. Okay, what does that mean? Save a life? It's as if you saved an entire world. So one way to look at it is that if you save this life, and this person then goes on to have children, and their children have children. There's a rabbi from Israel visiting, and I spoke to him. And he has, we say, Leon Harab, without putting an evil eye, he has 44 grandchildren. Okay? It's, a world. And they'll have children throughout the rest of history. So quality of life is absolute. The value of life is absolute and infinite. And a fraction of the infinite is, fraction of infinity is infinity. Okay, we don't have time to get into this, maybe in another class. But if someone tells you, hand over this person or we'll kill 1,000 people, in Jewish law, what do? Don't hand them over. Because who says one value of life is infinite? So whether it's one life or 1,000 lives or 10,000 lives, you can't trade them off. Life is, the value of life is absolute. Okay. So when medical ethics have these dilemmas, like the Karen Ann Quinlan case, who was kept on a ventilator from 1976 to 1985 for 9 years. And now, she was kept on it for 9 years, and you imagine the resources, the expense of doing so, and finally she wound up, the courts ruled that she could not be, her family did not want, once again, the family wanted her unplugged, I believe, but she's never given such a directive, so the court would not approve it. Okay. Now, how do we understand this on a spiritual level? And the question is, the larger question is going to be, is there ever a point where the quality of life is such that we can say life is not worth living? Right? Person's in extreme pain from a terrible illness, right? Can we say then that's the Kevorkian question? People who are in such pain said, I'd rather not live, I want to check out. So can one say that? Or even for a person who's not suffering but just They're in a state of coma. How do we understand that? So one way to understand it is that we're just talking about the soul. We believe a person is not just a physical body, but the person is a divine soul. And so one would say that even though the person is not conscious or awake, but the soul is still present in the body, and each moment of life, the soul continues to go through that process of growth, even if it's not on a conscious level. Very sad story. I had a student who, before MJ8, who had melanoma. He'd been a lifeguard when he was young. He sat summer after summer after summer in the sun. Which is kind of scary. I went to the beach the first 10 summers. And back then, you know, we weren't putting on sunblock. And he was 30 years, 40 years in the sun. And he got melanoma, and he got very ill, and he was in a coma. He got cancer, it spread, and he was in a coma. And I remember going to his bedside, and the doctors say, he's in a coma, he's not conscious, he's been out of it for days. And I said some prayers, and I was holding his hand, and I felt him squeeze my hand. Okay? And the doctors say, no, he's gone, he's not there. So, even on a conscious level, or a semi-conscious level, could it be that the soul had the power to come through, even when medically it was not believed so? So we're going to have to ask that question. But the basis for the Torah saying that the value of life is absolute, and we do not have the right to take another life, or even our own life, is because we believe that ultimately our bodies and our lives are not our own. And there's a famous verse, I think it's from the book of Job. It's said during the funeral, God gives and God takes. May the name of God be blessed. God gives life and only God can take life. Okay. So according to the Torah, even if a person is suffering a quality of life which they feel is not worth living, you're not allowed to take your life. Okay? It's very clear, the Kevorkian issues. And it's very interesting, in Holland, in certain countries in Europe where it is legal, there are people who were suffering severe depression, who wanted to end their lives, wanted to have their lives terminated. They, in the end, decided not to do it. And 2 months later, they came out of their depression, and they said, how could I have even thought about taking my life? So on a practical level, also, there are very severe questions. But from the Torah's point of view, it's not because when is a person competent to make the decision. From the Torah's point of view, it's not in our jurisdiction to be able to make that decision. Okay? Yeah. Well, this is So I'm talking here about actively injecting poison into them so that they cannot live. We're going to have to now look at, can you remove treatments or machines?
Like not install a pacemaker.
Right. Okay. So this we're going. This is in Jewish ethics will be a much more complicated question with much more room to discuss. But we're here talking about actively taking one's life. Kevorkian would go and help the people inject poison into their own system. Did he do it himself at times? I believe he even did it himself at times. So that's the first level. We're saying that level is completely forbidden. You cannot actively do something which will kill a person. Okay? And there's no discussion about that in Jewish sources. It's forbidden. A person who takes their life is not buried in a Jewish cemetery. Once again, there are questions of mental illness. If a person is considered to be mentally ill in doing it, then it's different. What is the definition of mentally ill? Today, pretty much the consensus amongst the rabbis is, if a person commits suicide, we assume they're mentally ill, and they are buried in the cemetery. because they did it out of whatever duress it was, you know, depression, self-destructiveness. So then the question is, the Torah does recognize a quality of life that might not be worth living, okay? But we're not allowed to take it ourselves. However, look at the second text. This is the story of Rabbi Judah, who actually wrote the Mishnah, the core of the Talmud. And Rabbi Judah, when he was elderly, was very ill. He had an intestinal disease. And let's just, without getting into the graphics, the Talmud gets into it a little bit. Was not pretty. So she prayed. Wow. Good time. Okay. Good thing we needed cheering one. The immortal desire of Rabbi to join them. In other words, the angels are calling Rabbi Yehuda, and the mortals desire him to remain with them. Okay? His students were praying that he remain alive. They didn't want their rabbi to be taken to the next world. They needed him. They needed their teacher. She said, "May it be the will of God that the mortals may overpower the mortals." First she was praying, like them, that he lived. When, however, she saw how often he resorted to the privy, wasn't pretty seeming, right? Painfully taking off his tefillin, putting them on again, she prayed, "May it be the will of the Almighty that the immortals overpower the mortals." Now, what's so interesting about this is Rabbi Judah's handmaid. She was Jewish, and apparently she was very learned. And what they did is, when they didn't know a law, they would go to her and say, "What was our teacher teaching on this?" In other words, she remembered all these different teachings. This is also fascinating. Also tells us something about the role of women in learning. You know? She had information. She could teach them. They got them. They would go to her. So she prayed. So she was conceived to be a woman of great wisdom. So she went and she prayed and asked that he be taken. So the first thing we see... Someone close the door. The first thing we see is that you're allowed to pray for someone else's life to be taken or your own. But if you're allowed to say to God, "You know what, God? It's not worth it." So you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to act on it physically, but you are allowed to have those thoughts and feelings. Okay, that's the first step. Now comes something even more extraordinary. As the rabbis incessantly continued their prayers for heavenly mercy, she saw that they kept praying, and so he wasn't leaving this world. She took up a jar and threw it down from the roof to the ground. She distracted them, and for a moment they ceased praying, and the soul of Rabbi departed. So not only was she allowed to pray that he'd be taken, but she was allowed to stop them from praying so that their merit would not keep her alive and she was taken. And he was taken. Okay? So the Torah does recognize that there's a certain quality of life that is not worth living. It's just we're not allowed to actively end our lives to take it, but we can ask God that be so. There's another text of the Talmud that we saw a few weeks ago where there's a woman who... was very, very old. And she was so old, apparently, her quality of life was so degenerated that she didn't want to live anymore. So she went to the rabbi and she said, "You know, I want to check out. I don't want to stick around. This is too much." So he says, "Tell me, what was your merit? Why are you still around?" Which is age, whatever she was, 102, 105. She said, "Well, I go to the synagogue twice a day." They said to her, "Stop going to the synagogue. It's on that merit that you are living so long." And she stopped going, and she passed away. So, also kind of reinforcing our point here. Now, so that's the first level of there's a recognition that there's a certain quality of life that is not worth living. So the second question is, if that is so, and I made a distinction before between actively taking a life or just not applying treatments that will prolong life. In other words, can a person say, I don't want to be treated? Don't hook me up to the machine. My mother had cancer, it was stage 3. And they told her, if we operate, you'll have a 50% chance of living 3 to 5 years. And she said, I don't want it. She was actually a nurse. And she never spent a night in a hospital and didn't want to. And she decided, I don't want to do it. And people were very upset at her. And I felt like, you know, this is her decision. And within Jewish ethics, one is allowed to make that decision. The strange thing, this was so strange, her best friend, her name was Deborah, her best friend was Dorothy. Both their Hebrew names were Devorah. They were the same age. They were diagnosed on the same day. Her friend decided to operate, and sure enough, I think she lived another 3 years. The Torah tells us that a person is allowed to withhold treatment. Look at text 3a. This is a very strange text, and we're going to have to kind of think about it, look at it. It's also a very dramatic text about the period of Roman persecution. And Rav Hanani ben Tradion, the Romans forbade studying a Torah. You know, you weren't allowed to study Torah. There was a Jewish dignitary who maintained good relations with the Romans who died. And the Romans went to the funeral, and all the rabbis were expected to go to the funeral. He was, of course, you know, the compliant Jew who cooperated with the Romans. So the Romans forced all the rabbis to go to kind of endorse his cooperation. So Rav Hanina ben Tradion went. He sat outside the cemetery with a Torah scroll open, studying. Talk about civil disobedience, right? So they took him, they wrapped him in the Torah scroll, and they burnt him alive with the Torah around him. But not only did they do that, they put wet wool inside the Torah scroll against his chest so that his torso, his lungs, and his heart would not be burnt and remained alive, and the rest of... Yeah. The Romans were expert torturers, extremely barbaric. Okay? Think about, you know, the civilizing Holy Roman Empire, but not always so. So here, you look at the underline. They wrapped him in the scroll, placed bundles of branches around him, and set him on fire. They then brought tufts of wool, which they had soaked in water, put them on his heart so that he should not expire quickly. And his daughter says, Father, how can I see you in such a state? He says, it's not me. My real grief is that the Torah scroll is being burnt. And another famous statement here between the underlined lines. Rabbi, what do you see? He said, the parchment is being burnt, but the letters are floating in the air. And there's many drawings of, you know, this beautiful imagery of the letters of the Torah floating in the air. In other words, the spiritual energy of the Torah was returning to heaven as the physical Torah was being destroyed. So, open your mouth, the student said, so that the fire may enter you. In other words, open your mouth so you'll die quicker. Right? He said, let him who gave me my soul take it away from me, but no one can injure himself. In other words, he viewed that as a form of euthanasia, to do something which will make him die quicker. The executioner then said to him, Rabbi, if I raise the flames and take away the tufts of wool from over your heart, will you cause me to enter the life to come? The Roman centurion, and there are many stories of Romans converting to Judaism, the Romans who understood the power and the depth of the Torah, and he said, he realized he had an opportunity. If I help you, will I go straight upstairs? The rabbi said, yes. Then swear to me. The rabbi swore that he would go into the world to come. He thereupon raised the flame, removed the wall from over the rabbi's heart, and his soul departed speedily. Okay. The executioner then jumped and threw himself into a fire. And a voice exclaimed from heaven, came down and said, that Hanani the Tragon and the executioner have been assigned to the world to come. When Rebbe heard it, he wept and said, one may acquire eternal life in a single hour. Another many years. In other words, this executioner, who was a brutal, he killed people for a living, entered the world to come. Why? Because he had one moment of tshuva, which is a whole other discussion of how you can acquire everything in one moment, whereas the rabbi worked spiritually for years for this, for another discussion. But the salient point is here, the Roman centurion took off the wool. So what's going on here? Opening his mouth he won't do, because that will speed up his death. But taking off the wool, what's going on? So this is the debate. The question is, what is the significance? Some people view it that normally, that if you look carefully, he didn't say to the executioner, take off the wool. He said, yes, if you remove it, you will have a portion of the world to come. So was he allowing the executioner to spare him or to kill him or to remove the things which prevented him from dying? But normally you would not be allowed to do that. In other words, is this a parallel to pulling the plug? Right? Person can't breathe, they have a respirator. You pull the plug, you'll die quicker. Or is this more like you remove... Well, it's similar, right? You pull the plug and he'll die quicker. You remove the wool and he perished faster. In the, you know, in the general case, it's a person's illness or their compromised physical state that causes them to die quicker. In this case, it was the fire that caused them to die quicker. That's the question. So, there is a law in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, if you look at number B. If there is anything which causes a hindrance to the departure of the soul, such as the sound of wood chopping or a lump of salt in the patient's tongue. Let's say there's something there that's preventing them from dying. What does that mean? I'm reminded of the story of, you know, the people praying, or the woman not going to synagogue, my great aunt, who unfortunately got cancer. She was very ill. And I would go in shifts with my second, she was my mother's cousin, my cousin once removed, her daughter, to the hospital. And I went to relieve the daughter, and I said, she came to relieve me, and I said, do you want me to come back after you've got to leave in like 4 or 6 hours? And she said, no, I don't want you to. She said, because her mother was holding on, and when there were people around, she was holding on. But her daughter knew if no one was around, she would let go and allow herself to leave this world. And sure enough, she didn't go back, and that's when her mother died. Interesting. So according to Jewish law, we know that's allowed, because it's like the prayers. You're not causing them to die quickly, you're allowing them to leave, and you're not doing anything physically. But the Code of Jewish Law says, if you have a light that's keeping the person distracted and causing them to hold on to life, or if you have, as you said, a salt in your under the tongue that is stimulating them and preventing them from leaving, from dying. Here it says you're allowed to remove that. Is that tantamount to removing a respirator? No. That is something which is there preventing them from dying. Whereas the respirator is something that is plugged in, which is keeping them living. Okay? There's a difference between something preventing them from dying or something which is maintaining their life. Okay? So there would be a distinction there. There's actually a debate about this. Rabbi Tendler, who's a very famous rabbi, biology professor, doctor. He's a rabbi, MD, PhD. I'm, I think, over-educated. So he actually compared the two. He said removing the wads of wool was removing the treatment which extended his life which was placed there, and brought him back to the original state he was in of dying in the fire. In other words, what he's saying is that you're allowed to, like you're allowed to remove the wads of wool, you're allowed to remove a treatment which might be extending life. Why? Because you're not killing the person, you're just leaving them in the state that they were in before. Okay? But the criterion he gives is that what they do is they test it. If the person is taken off the respirator and they can remain breathing on their own for 15 minutes, a half an hour, even if you know in 6 hours they might not be able to breathe on their own, according to him, since their life is still viable on its own, you can remove the machine, and then they're left in whatever state they're in, and then they can say, I don't want treatment. People following this? Okay. So, to sum up, a person can say, I don't want to be operated on. A person can say, I do not want to be put on a respirator. A person can say, I don't want an angio procedure where they, you know, put a stent in an artery. You can refuse treatment. That's not suicide. It's just saying, I don't want my life prolonged. And if you're plugged into a machine, it can be removed only if the person can be maintained in a state of life without the machine, at least for a certain period of time. Okay. However, so a person who is ill can say, I don't want surgery, I don't want chemotherapy, I don't want invasive treatment. However, the one thing which you cannot remove is basic sustenance. In other words, a person is not allowed to say, I don't want an IV. The question is, it gets more complicated if a person needs an IV and a stomach tube if they're not eating. But at least certainly an IV, a person cannot say, I want it removed. And you're not allowed to remove it if the person wants it removed. So a person has to maintain basic sustenance, otherwise it is considered suicide, but they don't have to accept heroic measures or treatment. Now there's a whole question of DNRs. DNR means do not resuscitate. It's basically when a person's heart fails, you've all seen it in the shows, right? They take the electric, what are they called? Any medical field people here? They take the defibrillator, they give the heart a jolt of electricity, and it gets the heart up and pumping again, right? The heart is an electric machine. Problem is, it can sometimes be very debilitating. Can break a person's ribs in the process of doing that. And if a person is brought back, they can be brought back with brain damage, with partial paralysis. So some people sign DNRs. The question is, in Jewish law, are you allowed to sign a DNR? So according to what we're saying, by the way, you should all be familiar with these because these are situations that come up. So according to what we're saying, you would be allowed to sign a DNR because it's heroic treatment. However, there's a famous rabbi who writes on medical ethics, Rabbi J. David Blight from Yorkville Synagogue on 78th Street. And he, when I spoke about it with him, he said the problem with the DNR is when doctors see the DNR, they tend to say, okay, this person is ready to let go, to give up, and they won't treat the person in general as well. So that's why he disrecommends DNRs. Not because it's not allowed, but because there are other treatments that might not be given once the person has signed the DNR. Okay. Now, the question, according to general law, we saw that it has to be the will of the person themselves to say, I don't want all of these, and that's why the living will is so important. Now, if a person signs a healthcare proxy, what they're saying is, I want this relative to make the decision for me. The Teresh Yadav case is so complicated. She didn't have a proxy, but he says she told him something verbally. And do you accept that? So, according to Jewish law, is actually not quite as strict. And there's some rabbis who say that it's possible that the relatives can make that decision for a person to withhold treatment, not just the person himself. according to American, what's interesting, this is a case where according to American law, it's more strict. And only the person themselves, if they say so, or if they left it in a will, living will, or if they signed a healthcare proxy to allow another person to make that decision for them. Okay? Do you have a question? No? Speak up a little bit.
Well, you're saying she doesn't want to be unplugged.
No, but I just want to say that she should be. Is that like...
She should sign?
Like, sign and say, like...
Well, you shouldn't coerce a person to do something that's not their will.
Like, she
has to... I mean, my father, he wanted to live till the last second. I asked him, you know, and his lungs were giving out. And I asked, do you want a respirator put in? He said, yes. And then they actually, his heart stopped, and they... question was to do the defibrillator, and I told him to do it because that was his will. And it was, they broke ribs and they were working for a long time. It was very strange, actually. If you want to hear this, this is all heavy and gory enough, but they worked on it. It was like 1 a.m. and they were working on them, and one of the doctors said time of death. And the custom is, if you're there when a person passes away, you rip your clothes. I tore my clothes and started saying I said the Vidu, the confessional prayer for him. I tore my clothes. I said the Shema, like you do when a person leaves this world. And then he came back. And apparently, the resident who was kind of standing there next to the whatever the rapid response team is the one who said time of death. He really shouldn't have, because he wasn't the person who was actually working on it. And they didn't. And it was a big mistake, but it was very strange. And then he was certainly, you know, didn't regain consciousness, and he passed away 6 hours later, almost mercifully, because he was in horrible shape. But that was what he wanted. So that's what I told him to do. That was his will. So you can discuss with a person and say, do you realize even according to Jewish law, you can refuse treatment, or you can have certain things, but you shouldn't pressure a person. Yeah.
Now there's different definitions
of death. Okay, so this is what we're going to get to. So, actually, before we get to that, let me just get to something else. So then we had this was 1:30 in the morning, and then the question was, could they give him morphine? Now, morphine suppresses breathing, and his lungs were already giving out, and he was on a respirator. But he was in pain because they'd broken his ribs. So I called my rabbi at 1:32 in the morning, and you are in a situation where you need to reach me, and it's a question of Jewish law. My phone's usually on vibrate. So no one else will be woken up, but I'll probably hear it. Shouldn't need it. Shouldn't happen. But this is, you know, part of being a rabbi. I called my rabbi at 2 in the morning. So I'm sorry to wake you up. My father, he knew my father. So the question was, if they gave him morphine, is that killing him? Because they knew that it probably would suppress the breathing, and he would live shorter on the morphine. So there the rabbi ruled that, once again, even though you're not allowed to give anything which will kill a person, since he was in pain, we were allowed to give him pain medicine, even though we knew it would probably shorten his life. So once again, it's not euthanasia, but it's giving him a treatment, and treatments, there's always, you know, counterbalance of side effects and things like that. So there it was allowed because you're giving him pain treatment. So now, coming to the other question. So the question of the Karen Ann Quinlan, who was in a vegetative state, that was 79 to 86. So now the technology has gotten much more sophisticated with CAT scans and MRIs. What happens is, if a person loses consciousness, stops breathing, their heart stops, their lungs stop, the blood, the oxygen stops going to the brain. And what happens is, eventually, after 10 minutes, the cells die. And if a cell dies because of lack of oxygen, it will never regenerate itself. It can't come back. There are different parts of the brain. There is the there's the involuntary part of the brain, which is the lower cortex. The part that runs the involuntary, the beating of the heart. The reticular formation, right? There's the lower part of the brain. I think that's called the lower brainstem. Generally, that's kind of a generic term. And there's the rest of the brain, which is the conscious part of the brain. So the question is, if there is lower brainstem death, in other words, if there's the part of the brain that even maintains the involuntary muscles and breathing, has died, and the person is being kept alive through a respirator. In other words, their lungs aren't working, but there's a machine forcing their lungs to have air going in and out, but their heart is still beating. So the question is that what we can call brain death? In other words, can you say that even though the person's heart is beating, they're technically dead because their consciousness will never return? The only part of their brain still alive is the involuntary part of the brain that is keeping the heart pumping, the heart ticking. And in general ethics, in secular law, lower brainstem death is considered death. In other words, the person is never going to regain consciousness. Now, this is different than a coma. There are people who have been in vegetative comas for 10, 15 years and have woken up from those comas. Just because the person is unconscious doesn't mean they'll never regain consciousness. The doctors don't know. They can't predict it. And there are times where it defies medicine. Okay? But not when the lower brain stem is dead. So if the brain cells are not dead, then according to Jewish law, certainly you cannot pull the plug if the person can't breathe on their own. According to secular law, if the person themselves says they want to pull, you could pull it. But if the lower brainstem is dead, now, according to secular law, you can unplug the person off the machines. And actually, most organ donations, the heart, the liver, have to be done not from a person who's died, but from a person whose body is still being maintained alive by their heart, but has brain death. In other words, if the heart sits for, too long, or the liver sits for too long, it's useless. So what they do is, before they pull, right after they pull the plug, they remove these organs, and then they give them to a donor. Now, according to Jewish law, there's an enormous debate about whether lower brainstem death is death. In other words, what is the definition of life? Is it the heart pumping, which had always been the definition of life? And by the way, there are a lot of very strange stories about people who were declared dead, and then what happens? They're on the mortuary table, and they sit up. So sometimes the breathing can be so suppressed that, classically they put, a piece of glass under the nose, and they saw whether there's any moisture or not, whether the person's breathing. But that's why today they're so exacting about taking vitals in terms of declaring death. What was the movie? Sherlock Holmes. Remember the guy who... see it, right? The guy, what was his name? The evil guy, right? He goes into this, catatonic state. They think he's dead, and then it turns he shows up again. In all these movies that happens, right? So it can happen, actually, where someone appears to be dead, but actually they just didn't check well enough. So, but with that aside, there's a debate in Jewish law of whether lower brainstem death is death. Now, it gets very complicated. Because even the rabbis who say it's not, and you cannot pull the plug, even if someone will never come out of the coma, will never regain consciousness, doesn't have a conscious brain that is alive anymore, the problem is those people will still accept an organ that was taken out of a person who was declared brain dead. So it's kind of a double standard. I mean, what they would say is, well, it wasn't taken out for this person. They did it, the organ's available, now it's available, we're going to accept it. So it's extremely complicated. But bottom line, there are rabbis who say that brain death is death. So you could pull the plug, even if the person cannot breathe on their own, because their conscious brain is gone, is dead. The cells are fried, so to speak. Now, Karen and Quinlan, who sat for 9 years, they didn't know. They didn't have CAT scans to put them through to see whether the brain stem was alive or dead. Okay, the final area we're going to look at, trade-offs in treatment, okay? So the first story I told you, what if you'll give a person painkillers, but it might speed up their death? So as I said before, that is allowed, okay? So the other question comes up. What if a person is told, we can do a procedure, you might die trying, but if we're successful, you'll live a longer life, such as an angioplasty. You know what an angioplasty is? They go with a tiny tube into the vein, usually from the groin. They go up into the artery. They put a stent, which is basically a pipe, into the artery, which is starting to collapse, to prop it open. And they put in a balloon. It's all microscopic. They inflate the balloon and pushes it out. Then they put in a metal erector set structure to hold it up, and the person can live. You know, my father had two of these, extended his life for 2-3 years. So they no longer have to open you up with open heart surgery. They just go in through the inside. You know, what was that movie when people are shrunk down? Inner Space, right? So Brave New World, we have it today in medicine. Okay. Not people going in, but it's, they even have a camera on the edge of this, you know, microscopic tube. It has cameras, they have tools, they have balloons. It's unbelievable. So, can you risk, but the problem is that when you go in, the tube going in might cause the whole thing to collapse before they can repair it. So you might die, but in the process, but if we're successful, you'll live longer. Allowed or not allowed? Would you do it or wouldn't you do it? Very good. So first of all, it depends on the odds. This is a code of Jewish law. If there's a 50% chance of death, but there's a 50% chance of cure, then it's allowed. But if they say there's a 60% chance of death, then in a sense you're putting yourself in danger, you're possibly precipitating your death, and it's not allowed. If the percentage of cure is greater, then you might have it might be that you have to get the cure. Okay? And generally, the Jewish approach to healing is that we are optimists. So, you know, some people are pessimists. Well, there's a 30% chance I might not survive. We say, no, you know, there's a 70% chance you will survive, so we're going to do the procedure, and God willing, you'll have a long life, and it'll bring you a cure. If the risk is an extremely long shot, basically the person is still allowed to try. Let's say the person feels like their quality of life is so bad that unless they get cured, they don't want to live this way. They're still allowed to try, okay? But if they say, if we're successful, then you'll have, you know, you'll be cured. Your heart will be restored. But if you know you're only buying a few months, and there's a high percentage that it won't succeed, then you're not allowed to try. You shouldn't even try. Because at best, you're buying a few months. At worst, you're dying right away. So those are the parameters of kind of these trade-offs. A lot of these are in the rulings of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was one of the greatest rabbis and wrote a lot about medical ethics for the 20th century. Died in 1986, I believe it was. If surgery will maim a person, like amputating a limb or something like that, a person is allowed to do it, but once again, they're not forced to do it, because we said you can choose to refuse treatment if you wish. I realize all this is not so so much fun, but certainly necessary. Let me just sum up the main point, and then we'll get to questions. So to sum up, in Jewish ethics, the value of the life is absolute. A person is not allowed to say, my quality of my life is such that I want to die, and I'm going to kill myself, or as they call it, euthanasia, or elimination of life. Okay? It's not allowed in Jewish law. However, there's still a recognition of quality of life, that a person can pray that they don't live, or they can choose not to get a treatment so that they should not live. Okay. Then we talked about if you can choose not to have treatment, are you allowed to remove treatment, such as a respirator? And here we said, if the person can survive on their own without the machine for a certain period of time, then you're allowed to remove the machine, even if you know that they might die sooner. Okay? And but the one thing you can never remove is hydration and food. That you're not allowed. And that a person is not allowed to refuse themselves. If a person does refuse, I don't think you coerce them to drink. But they're not supposed to refuse, and you cannot, certainly cannot, if they say, please take off my IV, you're not allowed to take it off and allow them to, in a sense, starve to death. And in terms of pulling the plug for brain death, according to Jewish law, some rabbis say that brain death is death. That's the only case you can pull the plug. And finally, trade-offs in treatment. We saw that if there's a 50% chance you'll survive, you're allowed to take the treatment. If it's an even higher percentage, you should take the treatment, even if your life is in danger. So those were the main points. Questions? Under which groups? Hospice. So according to what we're saying, hospice is... I talked about my mother's situation where she didn't want to go through operation and chemotherapy. Hospices, even people who do go through operations and chemotherapy, often there comes a time where the cancer is just so, you know, is galloping along that you can try and keep giving treatments, but chemotherapy has very bad side effects, right? People, nausea, and so there are people who choose to say, I'm just going to now allow it to take its course rather than going through more operations and more chemotherapy. So according to what we said, a person themselves is allowed to refuse treatment. So it's allowed. Yeah. My aunt, actually, this is back in the 1980s, she was in Calgary Hospital, which ironically crosses all over. But there was great treatment, and at the time it was one of the only hospices. Now they're much more prevalent, and there's Jewish hospice, things like this. Another form is hospice where they keep the person at home and give them palliative care. They give them pain medicine and allow them to be at home to die. So, any other questions? So 9/11, if you're in a building that's burning, well, the first thing we know is don't listen to the Port Authority. Make your own educated decision. You mean if you are in pain and you've got a fire burning at you, can you jump off in order to not be burnt?
See, they don't necessarily have to be like in the process of the burning, in the room where we know there's no fire.
So the case of King Saul, actually the famous case of euthanasia, of suicide, is King Saul, who was, the Israelites were being defeated in battle, and Saul went to his arms bearer and said to him, please take my sword and thrust it through me. The arms bearer said, I cannot do that. That's murder. I can't kill you. So he put his sword down on the floor and fell on him. Now, there's a big debate about, you know, this was the great King Saul, who was viewed as a righteous individual, although The most prevalent opinion in the commentaries is, very clearly, in the end of his life, he was had mental health issues. He was paranoid. He was trying to kill King David. He tried to resurrect Samuel to speak to him from the dead. He was not stable. So some people say, well, he was insane, and that's why he killed himself. Other people say that he knew he was going to be tortured. And because he knew he was going to be tortured, he was allowed to take his life. Now, can you say that someone who's in excruciating pain from a disease is different than someone who is suffering, burning in the fire? Let's go back to Rav Hanania ben Tragya. According to the people who say, how can you take off the wet wool? It's not like pulling the plug, because pulling the plug is just, okay, we won't give you treatment. According to some, taking off the wet wool is making you die faster. So if he wouldn't open up his mouth, why should he take off the wool? You understand? So the answer to that would be twofold. Either he didn't take off the wool, the centurion did, and he just didn't tell him not to do it. Remember, the centurion says, will I get the world to come? He says, yes, so he does it. Did he have to say, don't do that, don't kill him? Or you could say that maybe this is like a case of torture, that because the fire was burning him, he was allowed to take off the wool. But taking off the wool is still different than jumping out of a window, or like King Saul falling on a sword. So I do not know. But what I want to do is take the question, analyze it in light of the sources. Once again, this is how Talmudic law works. It's case law. You take the case of Rav Hanania ben Tragya, or the case of King Saul, you extrapolate the principles, and then you reapply them. Of course, the tricky part is figuring out what are the correct principles to abstract. What do we learn from the case? And often the Talmud will give a case and then analyze it and give you the principles that are meant to be learned from it by comparing it sometimes to other cases, right? So is the case of removing the wall like the case of Saul falling on a sword, who's going to be tortured? Is fire like torture, and therefore are you justified in actively killing yourself like King Saul did? So I would say it's not necessarily like the case of Hanania ben Tragya. Maybe that doesn't justify why he had the wool taken off, but it might be like the case of King Saul. So the commentaries who said King Saul was justified in falling on the sword because otherwise he would have been tortured, here I think you can say that fire is like torture, and jumping out a window is no different than falling on a sword. You're actively killing yourself. Based on that, there might be a basis to say it. I am not a rabbinic decisor. I do not handle life and death cases. I refer people to my rabbi, who, as I said last week, sometimes refers people to his rabbi. I mean, these are the kind of questions which go to world-class minds and rule people who are, you know, recognized as world-class experts, not just in rabbinics, but in rabbinic questions as they relate to medicine.
So what about the situation? Very shocked against so they created this kind of DNR.
But you would be
like you have like a do not resuscitate.
In other words, there's a good chance of living through the procedure, but if you get a heart attack, you don't want to live through it because you maybe might cause brain damage, and you wouldn't want to live with the brain damage. So we said you're allowed to sign a DNR, do not resuscitate, don't use the defibrillator. You're allowed to sign it because you're allowed to withhold heroic measures or treatments.
So can you go and have some kind of surgery?
Yes, we said even if it's a life-threatening procedure, as long as there's a 50% chance you'll survive, and by surviving you'll be cured or live a long period of time, then you're allowed to take the chance. And that chance can be piggybacked with the DNR. Yeah. You mean you're saying with the DNR, you're taking something which is not necessarily a life-threatening procedure, they say there might be side complications, and you're making it a life-threatening procedure, that's the but it's still the same principle of refusing treatment. But you're saying you're putting yourself in a situation by having a procedure which is going to provoke the situation which will require the treatment. Very interesting question. I don't know if that's... What we also see is very interesting in Jewish law, there's a very big difference between actively doing something, kevorkin, actively killing someone, and passively just allowing a disease to take its course and say, I don't want to be treated. That's not suicide, that's refusing treatment. So the Torah very much makes this distinction between active and actively doing something or passively allowing something else to happen. Yeah, Layla and Adele. If, sorry? Yeah. Okay, very good question. What about organ donation? Since I touched on it when I said, remember I said that the only time organ donations work with heart and liver are when you declare someone brain dead and pull the plug. Which, as you can see, complicates things because, you know, there's a lot of pressure on the medical establishment to find organ donors. And there's a strong feeling of it would be such a shame if you didn't use the organs to save another person. So, certainly one shouldn't succumb to pressure to say, well, we need this organ for so-and-so, so we'll pull the plug on so-and-so. That's killing one person to save another. That is forbidden in Jewish law. We talked about if someone has water in the desert, you don't take the water away from him to give it to another person. So, but organ donation in general, there's a misperception that Judaism does not allow more organ donation. That is a misperception, and it's not true. Judaism doesn't just allow organ donation, but it's a mitzvah to donate your organs if it's going to now. The distinction is it has to directly help the person. So there's a question about, first of all, research. Generally is not allowed. Okay? You say, well, if there's no research on Jewish corpses, then how are you going to find cures? Fact is, the research will be done by someone else. That's the reality of today. What if you had a world that was all Jewish? We don't. So you're not allowed to do autopsies just for research. But if it's going to directly go to save a life, so there's a whole debate about skin banks, where it doesn't go directly to the person, but you're storing it for them to then go to a person. So if it's life-threatening, definitely can donate your heart and your liver or a kidney to save a life. And by the way, you're allowed to donate your kidney if you're alive, if you have two kidneys, to someone who needs a kidney. And many people do that. You're allowed to donate an organ alive. You're allowed to donate when you're dead. Even non-life essential organs, like the eyes, can be donated because it's helping a person. There's an organization called Halachic Organ Donor Society, HODS, HODS.org. It was started by Robbie Berman, who was actually involved with Manhattan Jewish with us. He's now living in Israel. And they've saved thousands of lives. And they actually have, now this is another important point, you know, the back of the license, you can sign away for organ donation. Generally, we do not sign that away because that is a blanket permit to do whatever they want with the body. And once again, Jewish law, it has to go directly to help someone. Halachic organ donor card is saying, I'm going to donate my organs within the purview of Jewish law. And generally, what that means is, call this rabbi and whatever he says, follow his directives. So, I recommend getting a living will, getting a halachic organ donor card, making your loved ones known. You can get a living will, you should also have a regular will. These are just things one should do. Healthcare proxy, things one should have. I don't have all of them. My wife doesn't have all of them, but we know we have to do it. So I'm reminding myself as well. These are all things that a responsible person should do. So organ donation is not just allowed in Judaism, it's a mitzvah. And the problem is Israel has one of the lower averages of organ donations. And we're trying to change that. Because people have this misperception. They think, oh, if they take my organ when I'm resurrected, I'll be missing a limb. Tovel Bavamaisa is not true. Yes?
Is there a distinction between whether the organ is
don't believe so. I don't believe so. Yeah. Well, that's what we said. Some rabbis would recognize brain death. You can pull the plug, take the heart right away, and give it to a donor. And even the rabbis who don't allow brain death allow people to receive organs from someone who has been declared brain dead.
But if I know people that have been conscious for 20 years, and I think that if they just pull the plug, then you've got to kill
them. So once again, it depends if they have lower brain stem death or not. If the lower brainstem is dead, they will never regain consciousness. They just have part of the brain functioning that keeps their heart ticking, the involuntary muscles. Yeah.
If someone is suffering and the surgery would not be 50%, it would be 40%, what can they do if they're suffering?
I think we did say you could. It's not recommended, but if a person wants to do it, you can't tell them no. I believe that's it. Once again, any of these cases should be brought to a rabbinic expert. We've given parameters, but it doesn't mean you're an expert now and can go making rulings. But I hope it's given us some of the general principles that has let us realize the absolute value of human life that the Torah espouses. And once again, the depth of Jewish sources and that we have a Jewish tradition and source to go to in these heart-wrenching, ethically challenged and loaded situations. And for me, it's a validation of the depth of Torah and the extent of Torah wisdom. And this ends the Jewish ethics series, right, Kiri? Yeah, we do have in the shuffle. Next week we'll be beginning a new series on prayer. Okay? So the hows and whys, why do we pray, the how-tos, reasons behind prayer, techniques of prayer, which will go on for another 3 weeks, I believe. Next week we also have the special guest speaker, Gabriela Shalev, who will be speaking here at 8:15. There will be an admission charge of $5. She is the UN consul, the Israeli consul to the United Nations, and she'll be speaking about Israel at a crossroads, long and short term challenges. She just spent 2-3 years in the UN, which, as you know, is not the most Israeli friendly place. So we'll really hear from the inside the challenges Israel is facing at this point. It's in conjunction with JSCNY. We will be having regular Berlin series at 7:30 to 8:15. Join us outside for that, and then Gabriela Shalev will be speaking inside here. And then afterwards, we'll have refreshments back outside. At 6:45, personal growth through Torah, subject to be determined, and I'm open to requests. Tomorrow night, June 23rd, is our MJ East Side fundraising annual fundraising dinner at the Pratt Mansion. It's a beautiful event. We are offering half price to MJ participants, which means $180. I say again, we have free programming, free classes, we offer food, we offer cold beers. This is what keeps us going and allows us to run all these programs. So whether you'd like to come for that, we encourage you, if you can, if you can't swing it, give something, be part of it. It's really a way of giving back and showing gratitude and allowing us to continue to do what we do. This summer, join us in the Israel Heritage Trip. If you're interested in finding out more, please speak to myself or Shiri. And finally, Monday, July 5th, is the MG Summer Cocktails on the Roof, Americana Night. Okay, that's the Monday night of July 4th weekend. So when you come back from wherever you are at, come check us out. It'll be happening. Finally, we did have a Shabbat dinner scheduled July 2nd. The question is, are people here that weekend or not? Can I see a show of hands? Is there an interest in having a dinner July 2nd? People away? Some interest. Okay. To be determined. Have a good evening, everyone. Refreshments outside. Hopefully, they're still dry. And everyone's invited outside. and
thank you.